Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everyone. With that theme song, that means it's time for our monthly edition of Comic Book Corner, presented by Freakopolis Geekery in Whitehall, New York. This is our fourth show. Hard to believe, isn't it? And we've got some great stuff to talk about in this next hour. We're going to be talking about the Star Trek Discovery Succession issue number 3. A lot of good stuff going on there from IDW Publishing, written by Christian Beyer and Mike Johnson. And we're going to wrap up the show talking about Khan, inspired by events in Star Trek Into Darkness, 5-issue trade paperback published in 2014 by IDW. So, TJ, what do you say we jump right in and start talking about Succession? How does that sound?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea to start with Succession, one of our current, actually, I suppose the only current ongoing from IDW dealing with Star Trek until this Wednesday, but we'll get to that later. So Succession number 3 came out a couple weeks ago, not this past week, but the week before that, and things are really heating up in the Mirror Universe, huh?
Yeah, that I tell you what, we talked about this a little bit when we were doing our polls from last week, but Arium, man, she is a badass, huh?
Yeah, she was kick-ass in this issue, and we've known she's been, like, plotting at things throughout the first two issues, but we weren't sure if she was, like, part of the ongoing rebellion or if she was just striking out on her own, and we finally, that sort of came to a head in this issue, which she is on the cover of. Great cover, too.
Yeah, I thought, when I picked it up over at the store, I thought it was a Borg. The way they drew it, I didn't realize that it was her. I said, wow, it's the Borg, but it's not. It's just her.
Yeah, we still don't really
Excellent
know
issue.
What she is, right? I mean, apparently a cyborg of some kind. She hates to be referred to as a human, but I don't know if there's been any backstory to her in any books or anything.
Well, I think I brought this up on many shows on Trek Talkin'. This is my story and I'm sticking to it. When Captain Picard shot down the Borg cube in First Contact and it crashed in Antarctica and Captain Archer and found it way back then, I think that event changed the history of Star Trek as we know it. And now I think Arium might actually be a byproduct of that reverse technology that they found on that Borg cube. I mean, I'm not Borg sphere 200 years ago. Now, a lot of fans, you know, don't agree with that, don't like it, but that's my story, and I'm sticking to it because it makes perfect sense. It explains a lot of the technology changes and a lot of the differences between you know, what we see on Enterprise and Discovery versus what we saw on TOS. So I'm going with that she's kind of a byproduct of Borg technology. What do you think, Eric?
Well, I'm not sure if she's Borg or not, I definitely agree that she lives right on that line between human and not human, because it's funny, you know, like TJ said in issue number 3, she says, "Don't call me human." And yet, I believe it was in issue 1, did she take, yeah, I think she took over the Shenzhou and at the, near the, well, no, it was in issue 2, I think she took it over. Oh, no, it was in issue 1. Yeah. At that point,
yep.
She is also already saying, you know, that she was never accepted as a human. And it makes it sound like there's a deeper story back there. I'm almost wondering if, you know, maybe this was some kind of medical decision. Like, she didn't decide to upgrade herself with cybernetic parts because she's bored or because she wanted to, but maybe there was something, some sort of trauma in her past that caused her to need to, you know, become part machine. Maybe they didn't have quite the technology they needed to rebuild her in a human way, the same way that they can regrow limbs and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I don't know if she's Borg. You know, I do like your theory, Jim. I know we've talked about it a few times on the show, and I do think that there's the possibility that maybe that is driving some of the ways that they write these stories for these comics. But one way or another, I do think it's interesting that she lives right on that line between human and not human.
Well, you know what they say. When they took Colonel Steve Austin, they rebuilt him bigger, better, faster, stronger than he was before. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Exactly.
Every time we do something, you know, heroic in our family, we always do the ba-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na.
the bionic sound effect.
That sound, yeah. I love
that's
it.
How you knew when he was doing something spectacular, it would go in slow motion. Wow. The stuff we grew up with, huh?
I know, seriously.
What do you think, Charles? Thank you, Jim. What do you think, Charles?
I want a backstory. She is another character. I want a backstory on her. It might be down to the comics, but I think we need a backstory to find out a little bit about where she came from. And is there a big difference between Prime and Mirror? Maybe they have two different storylines between them.
Well, that is the $64,000 question, Charles, because, of course, Succession takes place in the Mirror Universe, so this would be the Mirror version of her. But is the Mirror version of an android or a robot really all that different from the regular version? Like, you know, a Mirror version of Data, you know, would still be Data, because Data doesn't act with emotion. So, you know, how much of what we're seeing of her in the Mirror Universe is reflective of what she's really like in the Prime Universe, since she's cybernetic?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean,
very
maybe
big
deal. Yeah, maybe the real question is what makes the Mirror Universe people the way they are. And I've always just assumed that it was, you know, some sort of trauma that happened way back when that maybe we don't know about that was different. Well, we kind of get some of that story in Enterprise maybe, but that was the caused kind of the fallout of everything else. I've always been really interested in not only what the similarities are, but the differences. And I think Arium, if she's at least part human, which I kind of consider Data part human, you know, because he's sort of, even though he's an android, he spent his entire life trying to learn more about humans and become more human and actually adopt their mannerisms. So, you know, we know stuff about the Mirror Data from the comics, but is that really what Mirror Data would be like? Or would Mirror Data just really be a little less brutal? You know, the Mirror Data we know is pretty nasty, I think.
Well, the Mirror Data that we know totally different backstory than the Data that we know in the Prime Universe. I think
right.
They took some creative liberties with that character. Now, I'm not complaining. I'm not at all. I'm just saying that they changed Data's backstory quite a bit for the Mirror Universe from what we know it was in the Prime Universe.
Yeah,
but,
so I wonder, you know, Arium here is kind of a hero almost.
when the Vulcan ship lands on Earth in the beginning of the Enterprise episode, A Mirror Darkly, that transpires exactly the way we know history to be. The Vulcans are exploring, and they find the warp signature. They land. He comes out. The live long and prosper thing. And what changes is that from conquering, kill them, and they rape the ship. So, you know, you got to ask yourself that, is that the defining factor that changes the course of the Federation? Is right there, or were they always bloodthirsty mongrels?
Yeah, interesting question. It could be the genesis of what we know as the Mirror Universe, yeah.
Because the Vulcans were still explorers, and they still landed. They didn't, they came there to explore and be friends, and if they knew that Earth was a bunch of savages, you know, would they have done that? So, I question whether or not it was that moment right there which defined what Earth would become in the future once they had technology that they stole from the Vulcans. All interesting questions. What do you think, TJ?
It's certainly possible, yeah. I mean, the nature of the way things change in the Mirror Universe is, I think, sort of at the core of this book. It is interesting, you know, Arium seemingly went through much the same, but just with a different outlook. We know, I think she might have been human at some point in time and is now potentially part cyborg, although, she seems in league, obviously, with the humans, so it's highly unlikely she was alien before that. Overall, I thought Succession number 3 was a really great issue.
Yeah, I was really surprised when they killed a character. Now I was wow.
Yeah. That was a big reveal for sure. Yeah. Amanda, right?
I was really surprised. Yeah, they killed Spock's mother.
Yeah.
Now, in the Mirror Universe, in this version, is Sarek, did Sarek die on the planet when the Emperor bombarded it, or did Sarek escape? Or do we not know that?
I don't think we know.
Yeah, I don't think we know, because they show all those mirror people, and then we know that the planet got attacked, but we don't actually know. They never went back to that storyline, so we don't know.
No. It is interesting, though.
So,
I mean, Sarek
could be alive.
Maybe he'll show up in the last issue, potentially. He could.
Yeah, I think Michael is one of the most interesting characters throughout this series so far, because I can't, even though we're 3 issues in, I'm not entirely sure what her motivations are. I mean, remember way, way back, so the there are a couple of time jumps that happen in this series. So at the very beginning of issue number 1, we get a scene of Mirror Michael and Mirror Lorca together, obviously in a relationship. And Michael is talking about how she needs to overthrow Emperor Giorgio. Fast forward 1 year, and the Charon is destroyed. And then in these latest issues, Michael saying things like, well, Emperor Giorgio wasn't that bad. It's really Alexander who we have to kill. And so I'm wondering if her, you know, even though she's kind of allying herself with some of the people who appear to be part of a resistance or rebels or maybe even another group, if really in the end this is all about Mirror Burnham trying to ascend to the throne or not.
Yeah, you're right. Because she hangs around with Harry Mudd at the refugee camp, giving the BB-8 balls and stuff to the kids. And she doesn't really act like a Mirror Universe Terran would. She's closer to the Michael Burnham that we know, then, you know, like Emperor Georgiou, yeah, she would definitely act that way because she's just evil. Well, she's a Terran. And so, you know, she eats Kelpians and that kind of thing. Whereas Michael Burnham seems to be more on par with our Michael Burnham, I think. Well, what do you think, Jamie?
Yeah.
Do you think that the Michael Burnham that we see in the comic books is very similar to the one that we see on the TV show? You did read that the book, right, James?
Well, yeah, I think she's pretty close, if not the same. I'm actually shocked at how accurate her character is in comparison with the actual TV show. And I heard you guys mention this earlier when I came on, but I'm really shocked that they actually killed Spock's mother. That was an irony for me. I didn't know that was happening. I mean, I did, but I didn't. I knew someone was going to die. And then when I did read that page, I was like, oh my God, how did this happen so fast? But I guess it did, and wow.
Yeah, I was shocked. I was really surprised, but this is also, if you think about this, it's a mirror. If you think it's a mirror, TJ, because let's take Lorca. Let's use Lorca. We saw Lorca survive in the Prime Universe as a Starfleet captain, and we all bought him in that role. He had some eccentricities about him. We knew he wasn't quite right, but he fit that profile, and he carried it off well. And we didn't see the true Lorca come out till he got back to the Mirror Universe and tried to, you know, take over. So we know that the Terrans are able to be chameleons. But when we look at Michael Burnham in the Mirror Universe and we compare her to the Michael Burnham that we saw from the Prime Universe when she went to the Mirror Universe, the characters, I think, are very, very similar. Or did you notice that, TJ?
You know, I hadn't thought about it before, but you guys are definitely on to something. There's a panel in here shortly after the halfway point in the book, right as they're getting beamed down to Alexander's throne room, where Michael Burnham, just before that, she says, my mother was an old fool. I have no wish to follow her path. I'll find a path of my own on a planet very far from here. So it seems like it's not a power play, although, you know, she could be just holding her cards close to her chest. We also know Cole stabbed her when he first met her while they were leaving Kronos, and for being the butcher of the binary stars, which is very much what Michael Burnham probably would have been labeled in the Prime Universe had her plan gone through. It seems that in the Mirror Universe, she probably did stop the Klingons beforehand. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of her actions tend towards the Michael Burnham we're very familiar with.
Yeah, and you know, I'm still trying to figure out where did she come from, Eric? We don't really know, do we? Or did I miss something?
Where Michael came from?
Yeah, because the Michael in the in Discovery, when they're in the mirror universe, we're told that Michael disappeared when she went after Lorca, and both of them disappeared. Now we know that Lorca ended up in the Prime Universe, but we don't know what happened to Michael Burnham, unless she's in the Prime Universe as well, and there's actually two Burnhams in our universe, and we're not aware of that point yet. Maybe we don't know. But in the comic books, she just shows up and with no explanation as to where she was or how she got there, unless I missed something when I was reading it.
No, they don't actually say how she got from where she was supposedly chasing down Lorca, which I think is also, once again, an interesting question. You know, we were told in the show that it was Lorca being chased, and then there was an accident that caused him to come, or some sort of spatial anomaly, I can't remember what it was, that caused him to come into our universe. And we're told in the comics here that Mirror Michael was chasing Lorca But, of course, at the beginning of issue one, we've got Mira Michael and Lorca in bed together. So it was she really chasing him down? Was she actually – was Mira Michael's job actually to somehow assist Gabriel Lorca in getting to the Prime Universe? I mean, I don't know if there was – intent there, or if it really was a accident, and then he took the opportunity when he got to the Prime Universe, or that sort of thing. But I don't think we're clear on Michael's story yet, and what her motivations are. I mean, you guys are right. She does seem to have some positive intent here, but I don't really trust her quite yet. I think she could be, you know, one of the good guys of the Mirror Universe, so to speak. She's definitely anti-Alexander, but she was also anti-Giorgio. So, I don't know. She doesn't... Arium, to me, seems to be the only one right now who is really fighting against the paradigm that currently exists in the Mirror Universe there. You know, she seems like she's kind of gone rogue. At the end of this issue, it appears like she's gotten a hold of this genetic weapon that Alexander was trying to develop, and that perhaps she has modified it in a very interesting way. I don't know how many spoilers you want to give on the show, but you know, it looks to me like she's about to use it in kind of the opposite way that it was originally supposed to be used. So, you know, maybe she's the real hero of the series. I don't know.
Well, we're overlooking one very pivotal, very important piece of this puzzle, and that is Michael Burnham is Spock's sister. And we know what happens to Spock in the Mirror Universe. So is it possible that Spock has been communicating with Michael Burnham and that she's actually helping Spock take over and put his plan in motion? What do you think, Charles?
I think not, because Spock doesn't change his views until he meets Kirk. And this is going to be pre-Kirk era. So I don't think Spock's made up his plan yet. I think he's still believed to be pure Terran right now. But
I'm just throwing stuff out there.
Well,
interesting question.
I'm going to throw another one out that's going to make things interesting. We have Spock on board the Enterprise. Okay, I guess they rebuilt the Enterprise because somebody just blew up the Enterprise.
Well, actually, they blew up the Constellation.
No, I think it was 1701.
No,
they
it's actually 1071.
Note.
It's a very similar number, but at the
oh,
or
I
1017.
Was,
sorry.
Because I thought that was like the Enterprise they took out. On that.
Yeah,
one.
The end of issue two, they sort of show the USS Constellation NCC 1017, and that's the one that got blown up, captain by.
That's the one.
By
getting
Deckham.
I got the two ships mixed up. I just took a quick look on it, so.
Which actually is really awesome if you think about it, because which is really cool, because when they actually showed the USS Constellation on TOS, that's exactly what they did. They just switched the last two numbers around, and when they did that in the Mirror Universe, I was like, well, that's a good homage to the original Star Trek, that they kept the same registry number as the Constellation had on TOS. They just switched the number around. I thought that was pretty cool. But let me see. Oh, wow. So overall, though, what did you think about this story and where it's going overall, Charles?
Very good. I'm already went on looking. It's like, okay, when's the next issue coming out? It's like, oh, good. I got a couple weeks to wait. But we hit that last thing. It's like, okay, we're coming to a serious point. And it's like, okay, to be continued. It's like, oh, that was a major cliffhanger. Sit there and just leave it. It's like, okay, you'll find out next issue. It's like, I'm not sure I want to wait
long. I enjoyed it, too. I thought it was really well done. I thought it was a great story.
Yeah.
And I really am enjoying seeing them building up a lot of these background carriers, like in particular Arium, and getting to see what Harry Mudd is doing in the Mirror Universe. And, you know, it's just it's a fun story to read. And watching these characters, some of them we've never seen before, is really a lot of fun.
Well,
what about you, Eric?
One of the things that threw me in this issue was, as I was reading it, I started reading the first few pages. I missed the caption on the first page, on the first cell. And it's like, well, wait a minute, what happened here? Then I had to flip back. It's like, oh, 18 months ago. Oh, okay. So that was a good one, because that threw me off, not realizing we were going back in time. But that was a very good, I think, opener for the story.
Now, since Kristen Beyer is no longer working on Discovery, I'm wondering if they're going to stay on the comic books, or if she's been completely fired totally. Does anybody hear anything about that?
No news yet.
Because I know one of the things that we've liked about these comic books so far is that they followed the episodes, which makes sense because she's the head writer for the show. So having her work on the comic books keeps that continuity alive. Well, now that she's been fired, is she still going to be doing these comic books, or are they going to have, you know, just somebody walk in cold that's not working on Discovery work on the comic books? And if they do that, will it change the quality of the comic books? I'm just thinking out loud.
Go ahead.
I think the last issue we know she's written, is the last issue of Succession. So, nothing new yet coming from her. The Star Trek versus Transformers is not her. Terra Incognita, which comes out this week, is not her. So nothing so far indicates she'll be writing anymore, but possible.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Well, something I remember something being said, I don't know, JK mentioned or somebody else mentioned it, but that another reason all the series were coming to an end for Star Trek is this summer they were going back and reevaluating what they were doing. So I think she losing her out may be part of that reconstruction to seeing what they're doing, which is why we've gotten the other one ended. So I think. Boldly Go. Now, I'm be waiting to see what might come out this weekend or two more weeks. Because those that may not realize it, this weekend, actually this week, is San Diego Comic-Con. The 1st of August will be Star Trek Las Vegas. And Star Trek Las Vegas released some very good information last year that I was able to get to the podcast. So maybe between those two, we're going to get some details of what's going on with IDW.
Well, J.K. is at San Diego Comic Con, so he'll have some inside
J.K. will be at both.
Info. If he can talk about it, I don't know if he's allowed to say anything. But I will say this though, I don't think that it's a coincidence at all that Christian and the other dude were fired there, whose name escapes me. And they gave the $5 million contract out to Kurtzman, And at the same time that all of that was happening, IDW wraps up to boldly go. They kind of put the brakes on their Star Trek projects. And then we hear that there's not one, not two, not three, not four, but five new Star Trek series that are in the works that are going to be coming at us. And I just think that all of that is too coincidental. And I think that IDW would definitely be working on those comic books for all those projects, whatever they may be, and that they may be wanting to get a fresh start with new projects and not try to have them entangled with old projects. I think that's just my opinion.
Right. Well, it wasn't when I say the discussion of IDW at Star Trek Las Vegas, it wasn't JK that made the announcement. IDW and Star Trek made the announcement. In fact, IDW had their own panel last year. I'm hoping they have one again this year. And I think if they do have their panel, we're going to get a lot of details then about what's going on.
Yeah,
so that's
why
I said,
he knew about the miniseries, but he couldn't tell us because he has a contract. But
right,
we will definitely get JK on maybe the next Comic Corner if he's available. But we will get him back on because he loves to come on and Trek talk with us. So I will get in touch with him, and we will get him back. So don't you guys worry about that. And if anybody's listening, I have faith that you'll call 646-668-2433. We would love to hear from you. And don't forget, you can check us out on iTunes, Trek Talk, and under podcast. So,
well,
Eric, what's your take
hope,
on oh, – go ahead.
Going to say, I plan and hope to see him at Star Trek Las Vegas. So I'll try catching him myself too.
Well, that's right. You'll see him before I'll talk to
him.
So Eric, what are your thoughts on this on issue number three?
Well, I love issue number three. What's interesting is the one thing that we didn't talk about yet is the beginning of issue three actually starts out. In a time frame that says 18 months ago. And so if you time it with issue one, where they indicate that Michael and Lorca are in bed a year before the Charon's destroyed, we find out that Michael is and Lorca are presumed missing and dead, or both dead, I guess, at least 6 months before the start of that first issue. So we know now, as of issue three, that when we see them in bed at the beginning of issue number one, that actually is after they're supposed to be gone and dead. So, presumably they're on the lam and plotting together how to take down the Emperor. I really like this series so far. I mean, we've talked a lot on the show about how we all kind of like these mirror universe stories because they give us a little window into what might happen to human beings if things were just a little bit different, you know, if Zefren Cochrane had shot the first Vulcan instead of embracing them as peaceful, bringers of knowledge and technology. I guess one of my favorite things about this whole series is how they are bringing out some of those other characters. We've talked quite a bit about Arium and the important role that she's playing in this. I feel like this series is also really developing Cornwall. She's got, she's in the earlier issues, and then you kind of jump back in time and you see that she promises to be completely loyal to Giorgio back in the day, but yet she's kind of got something going with Lorca on the side. I don't think it's a romantic thing. It appears from what we've seen so far to be just a similar thinking business type relationship. But there are so many people plotting against so many people in the mirror universe that sometimes I think it's hard to keep track of, who's on whose team. We got to learn a little bit more about Harry Mudd. you know, so I love the development. Laurel turns out to be really important in the Mirror Universe, and this series is kind of developing her character a little bit more, somebody who we just got to barely see, a couple of these characters we just got. I don't think we saw any Mirror Cole in the series, so we get to see a little bit what he's like. I just love the expansion of the universe, of course, which is what the comics are all about. You know, like J.K. says, canon adjacent, it's all the stuff that fills in the gaps between all the major stories that we already know. I do like Alexander as a character. He seems to really embody fully the Mirror Universe tyrant. You know, it's interesting. I guess Alexander has made me kind of reevaluate Mirror Giorgio a little bit. Alexander is playing the typical young, inexperienced, probably going to get smacked down at some point type character. Gosh, what's the boy king's name in Game of Thrones? Like that type of character.
Joffrey.
Yeah, Joffrey, right. He's playing the Joffrey character in this right now. And yet he's kind of, you know, he's ruthless, but it's almost like he doesn't understand what he's doing or I don't know if he has a long game or not. I guess what I'm saying is I'm interested to find out if Alexander is actually smart or if he's really just another tyrant who just wants power. Whereas obviously you've got people like Michael Burnham and Cornwell who are trying to bring down the system, it appears, but it seems like neither one of them has any interest in any kind of emperor-type setup. I thought what you said, Jim, about Mirror Spock, I hadn't really put that together before. You know, at this point, Mirror Spock would be Mirror Spock. It would be pre-Kirk. So he would be, you know, he would be in charge of things, and presumably he would have some kind of, you know, rules that he'd set up or way that he's choosing to run the Empire. Maybe, you know, maybe Michael Burnham is working with Mirror Spock. I'm not sure. I think that's kind of an interesting idea that they may not explore in the comics, but it was one that I hadn't thought about before.
Well, Kirk convinced him to throw everything away pretty easily, if you think about it. You know?
Yeah, I mean,
he
it's
just
almost
said,
like
you know,
he was already thinking
every
about
revolution
it. Yeah.
Every revolution needs one man and one idea. Be that man, Spock. I shall consider it. And that's all it took for him to flip. So he must have had those thoughts prior to Kirk telling him that. Because he flipped really.
Yeah, I mean, he did. And I think that, you know, Kirk was no great orator, I don't think. I don't think, you know, he was a better kind of like get his hands dirty and get into the muck kind of leader. I think you're right. I think it must have, you know, it could have been that Mirror Spock had kind of already been headed down that path or had already been thinking about it. Or, you know, I mean, we all know Spock is hyperlogical. And so even though in the episode Kirk poses to Spock in Mirror, you know, he says logically things can't continue the way they are, Spock had probably already worked that out for himself.
I think so.
So anyway, completely love issue number 3, completely love the series so far, and I feel like they've left enough cliffhangers. The end of every issue is a great cliffhanger. You never know what's going to happen next, so I'm all in. I love it.
And you know something else that's cool about what you were saying before is if we go back 18 months, that gives us a good idea as to when Lorca came into our universe, because we don't know how long he was there. We know that Cornwall had a relationship with him at one point, and when she comes aboard the Discovery and has another relationship with him, she realizes something's wrong with him. But we don't really know how long he was in the Prime Universe. If you use that as a gauge, it gives you a good idea as to when he actually came here.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's and it also shows us, like I was saying, that Lorca and Michael were on the lam from the Emperor before the beginning of this series. So, you know, it really lays out some good timing that when you kind of put the puzzle pieces together with the show gives you a much clearer picture of it must have been that you know, I mean, I guess what we don't know is at the beginning of Succession 1, are the two of them in the Mirror Universe or are they in the Prime Universe? I'm assuming they're in the Mirror Universe because we never know that Michael travels to the Prime Universe. That was never revealed in any way. So I'm assuming that very first panel that we see at the beginning of the series, they're in bed in the Mirror Universe and that happens before Lorca gets transported to our universe.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right about that. I said that before. We don't know what happened to Mirror Michael. She could have come with him, and they could both be in the Prime Universe, and we just haven't seen her yet. We don't know. And that's the great thing about it. It gives us all these theories to talk about, because that's what fans do. So, Jamie.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, you've been awful quiet. I know you read this book. What did you think about it, and would you recommend it to people who haven't read it yet?
Yeah, it was definitely a great read, and it's definitely full of cliffhangers and surprises in every page, and I'm actually really intrigued by the relationship between Michael Burnham and Laurel, which leads me to thinking, okay, well, we don't really know what happened to Lorca, how did he get from point A to point B. We don't know what's really going on with Michael Burnham, so to speak, in the comic book between the TV show. But the reason I say that is because there was one where Laurel and Burnham were talking, and it just got me thinking, okay, so in the show, we know they're enemies, that Klingons and just anyone on the Discovery wouldn't be talking. So maybe our little theory, Michael Burnham has been talking with Spock, and maybe they got together and said, well, maybe we need to form this relationship with the Klingons to keep ourselves protected from enemies or something along those lines.
Yeah, because we know that, like we said, we know that Spock, the seed is in Spock, and we know it's growing. And so it would make perfect sense because, I mean, if you look at Star Trek VI, only Spock could go to Kronos. And so it would make perfect sense that in the Mirror Universe, Spock hooks up with the Klingons there as well. So, yeah. So overall,
okay.
I think that...
Jim, can I throw a monkey wrench in our story?
Absolutely.
Quoting from Succession 2, I am merely stating a fact, cousin. You're an orphan who got lucky. The Emperor took pity on you and gave you a home. That doesn't make you royalty. It doesn't make you the legitimate heir. No matter what happens, you'll never sit on that throne. Was the mirror ever adopted by Ferrick?
Interesting. Wow.
This may be the tie-in because of the Vulcan discriminatory toward Vulcans and other non-humans. Was she attacked and adopted by the Emperor, not the Sarek?
Excellent point. And I think, you know what? That makes a lot of sense, Charles, because... You know, that would mean that she probably never was educated as a Vulcan. So she doesn't have that kind of logical component of her persona that our Michael Burnham always seems to be fighting with, but also using to her advantage. Huh. Interesting.
And not to go against canon, because I know we have a lot of people that the canon is the Holy Trinity, and you can't mess with the canon. But, you know, the TOS episode really goes against canon because Spock is the first officer on the Enterprise. And we know that Vulcans are in the Mirror Universe are like the lowest of the low, and you would never have a Vulcan first officer on the flagship of the Empire like we see in that episode. You know, they're miners and workers and that
Spock
type
isn't
of thing.
Human. Spock isn't Vulcan. Spock is half Vulcan.
Yeah, I do think that works to his advantage in the mirror universe.
So in the mirror side, it's possible. So it's possible that maybe he was taken pity on being half human and allowed to maintain his human side.
Which would fit with it, with Irium's backstory.
Which is why Spock
would
be on the Enterprise in the mirror side.
We'll just have to wait and see where this story takes us. But overall,
yeah,
I think that Succession issue number 3 is an excellent read, and I would recommend it to anyone that's looking for some good Star Trek to get into. So, anybody else want to say anything about Succession number 3 before we move on to Khan? Okay.
I'm good.
So our next, go ahead.
No, I said I'm good. Nothing else to say. It's good.
Go
out and buy it.
go out and get it. Our next book that we're going to talk about is a 5-issue miniseries called Khan. And this is not to be confused with the Ricardo Montalban Khan, which takes place after The Wrath of Khan, where we see Khan on SETI Alpha. This is not that story. This is the story that's inspired by the events of Star Trek Into Darkness. So this story takes place in the Kelvin timeline. And this is a really good story. I enjoyed this one, and it answers a lot of the questions and a lot of some of the problems that the Canaanites had with Cumberbatch playing Khan when he was supposed to be Asian and so on and so forth. So, TJ, why don't you lead us off on your take on Khan?
Yeah. So I read that this afternoon. Khan takes place sort of after Into Darkness and tells us the origins of the Khan we know and love, and does a pretty good job of explaining, I think, why it's funny they mention, you know, within the first couple pages, why he doesn't look like Khan Union Singh that we know, like Montalban's, but instead as Cumberbatch. They explain that nicely away throughout the issue. They also give us a bunch of backstory in terms of Earth in the 20th century and the things that happened there, as well as the eugenics war. So overall, lots of sort of exposition through the lens of Khan telling his origin story. I think they covered a lot in these 5 issues, but overall a pretty solid little mini series. I think it all worked together pretty well.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, and I have to think that the backstory that we see for Khan in this, even though it's Khan in the Kelvin universe, all the stuff that happens pre-Kelvin, I think, is the same history. I think the eugenic wars and the Botany Bay and World War III on Earth and all the events that we see through Khan's eyes on Earth, I think all that stuff is prime time history. And the Cumberbatch Kelvin Khan doesn't come into play until after the Narada goes through the wormhole. So I think all that stuff can be considered to be actual canon. At least that's the way I look.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, the changing moment besides the Narada was the Admiral there actually finding the Botany Bay before Kirk did and sort of awakening Khan and capturing all his other genetically engineered soldiers.
Yeah, that altered the timeline a tad. Yep, that did indeed. Yep, that did. But overall, I what did you think, Eric?
Well, this comic was what I wish Star Trek Into Darkness was. Like, if they had just completely tossed the other story and given us this story on screen, I think it would have been really interesting, and I think that it would have set Khan up, Benedict Cumberbatch as Khan, as a better character for future movies. I mean, imagine if this story had been told in Star Trek Into Darkness. I think that you could have then taken the Khan character and made him last maybe for more than one movie. Because, you know, unlike most people, I actually kind of liked Star Trek Into Darkness the way it was. I did not mind him the way that he played the character. I really needed some reason that he was European and not Indian. And so this comic book gives me that explanation, which I think is sorely needed, and I think is actually may have made Cumberbatch more convincing as Khan. I mean, you got to kind of, in some ways, you got to look the part, right? And he didn't look the part in the movie, and this comic gives you a great backstory to that. But I really like this comic. You know, I read it kind of back when it first came out, and then I reread it, of course, as we were approaching our comic corner here. You know, it's pretty simple the way it's laid out, but I like the art, and I like the kind of amount of detail you get, particularly about the eugenics wars. Charles said something about that. That's always been an interesting part of Star Trek that we haven't necessarily seen it on screen. They've talked about it a bit, but we haven't seen it on screen. We haven't really seen it, to my knowledge, in another comic book series, unless there's some older comics that talked about it a little bit that I'm not familiar with. Overall, pretty good story. And, you know, the first three issues I really liked. The fourth one was a little jarring at first because it kind of drops you in a different place in the story. And then it kind of works its way back, and you figure out what's going on at the beginning of issue four, which body Khan Singh is inhabiting. And so that was a little bit of a weird decision there. It disrupted the continuity a little bit, but then they brought it back, and it kind of made more sense.
Yeah, I thought it was. I really found it when we see Khan in the original Space Seed, he's just referred to as genetic Superman and blah 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 blah, and we just accept that, we buy it, we go with it, and that's cool. And then he comes back in the Wrath of Khan, and again we just buy it, we go with it, awesome. Well, Into Darkness that comes along, and I had this happen to me. I went to see Into Darkness with Jamie because she had never actually she wanted to go see that with me. Well, we're in the theater, and all of the millennials are in there, and here's me, the old guy. And they're watching this movie, and when he says Khan, I'm like, oh, my God. And no one in the theater really seemed to care because to them, Khan, yeah, so what? Who's Khan? Big deal. It's Khan. And they had no idea who Khan really was. Had they had a Ricardo lookalike or somebody that resembled Ricardo play that character from the start, do you think that maybe it would have taken some of the air out of that balloon when they finally made that announcement, because JJ was trying to keep that so top secret for so long? And, you know, if he looked like Ricardo, that may have ruined the big reveal later on in the movie. I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah, I think what they did was I actually haven't read any background on this, but this is my guess. My guess is that they picked the actor, the biggest actor that they could afford that they thought could really play the part. And then they kind of tried to work the story back from there a little bit. I don't know, maybe they had the story first, but they don't, you know, I guess, yes, that would have been one way to go, but then the other way to go would be to just tell the story of why he looks like a European first, you know, just tell that part of the story, maybe take the first. I mean, you might even be able to compress that story into, I don't know, 20 minutes in the movie or something, or maybe as a series of flashbacks. You know, I don't mind. I actually, you know, at this, I mean, there's no question that Ricardo Montalban is the classic Khan, right? But he's also not Indian, so he's really not even in the same. You know, he feels more exotic to people because he speaks with an accent and that kind of stuff. And I actually don't know where the actor comes from, you know, just what country he hails from. So we've always had this character Khan Noonien Singh, who hasn't necessarily lined up with his name. I think when you watch Kelvin Universe movies, you just got to be along for the ride, man. I don't mind that they change things up, and I think they do a decent job of explaining how things are different and why things are different. And this comic really, I think, is an excellent way to lead into that second movie, which I didn't think was that bad. But I know I'm in the minority there.
Well, no, I happen to enjoy all of the Kelvin movies myself. But you know what? We have an opportunity here. We have a rare opportunity here, Charles, because we have two millennials right here with us right now on the radio with us. So why don't we ask them? So TJ, what were your when you saw Into Darkness for the first time and you found out that Cumberbatch was Khan? First of all, were you aware that there was another Khan and another movie and another TOS episode that took place before this one, or were you just cold cocked when you found out that was Khan and it really didn't matter to you and it was just another character? How did you feel when you saw this movie for the first time?
So at the time, I knew Khan was obviously an antagonist of the TOS crew. I knew there was the Wrath of Khan, but I'd never seen Space Seed. I'd never seen the Wrath of Khan. So I didn't know quite, I knew he was a big deal, but I didn't know the details of it. Still, though, I thought the casting, I don't know if I would say I'm a big Benedict Cumberbatch fan, but I think he can be pretty sinister, so I was excited to see him play a villain. And then I went into Darkness having mostly seen like reruns of Next Gen when I was a kid and the 2009 Star Trek. That was most of my exposure at that point, being a soon-to-be 25-year-old now. Yeah, and then I quite liked Into Darkness. Well, it was in theaters. I still like it now. I still like all the Kelvin movies. So I knew it was significant, but not quite, the reasons behind it.
Yeah, and, how about you, Jamie? I know that I've made you suffer through the Wrath of Khan, so I know that you have seen the Wrath of Khan. Whether or not you knew that was the same character when we went to see Into Darkness, that I'm not sure, but I know that you've seen The Wrath of Khan as well. What did you, when you and I went to see that movie, well, what did you think?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it. In fact, I just watched it a couple days ago again. So as a refresher, I knew that was Khan. So yes, I did make the comparison and I was aware of that, but I do definitely think it would have made a lot more sense if they had portrayed the character a little bit better by having someone else play it or act the character out. I mean,
yep. You still there? I think I lost Jamie. Okay, I'll have to see if I can get her back on the switchboard here. So, Charles, what were your thoughts on this and on the Khan backstory?
This was actually the filler that I wanted to see. When I heard about this one and finally got to read it, it's like, there's a missing story. There's a backstory for me that I was missing. Now, to kind of tie in with your original Star Trek versus Kelvin, I went and saw the movie with a couple of friends, I think the weekend, if not the night it opened. I was going in this one thinking, they don't know who this villain is. I bet it's Khan. Then we went to the beginning. It's like, okay, maybe it's another villain, but I'm kind of unsure. And then when they popped in and said, oh, I'm Khan, it's like, That's exactly what I thought, that I was expecting him. But I'm also a Cumberbatch fan because I'm also a big Sherlock fan. And I love his rendition of Sherlock. So I was already a fan of his thing in the movie. And the movie, I thought he still played a very good con because he still had the strong intelligence and he still had the fight and the strength that Khan had, even if he didn't decide he needed to show off his chest to show the muscles. So I thought that he played a very good Khan. But one of the things I've always run through...
I didn't mind him. I agree with you. I completely agree.
Well, one of the things in there is, I've heard, the eugenics war. The eugenics war. And I turn around and say, well, what was the eugenics war? You'd sit there and say, oh, it's the eugenics war. Eugenics war. It's like, well, tell me about the eugenics war. This sat there and told me about the eugenics war. What was the pre part of it? How it led into it? How Khan eventually left the planet? How we ended up aboard the Bounty? So that we actually got the details of how what happened in there. So that we understand what would happen, what would have happened in the Prime Universe, and compared to what did happen in the Kelvin universe. I think it tied both stories very well, and we got an understanding of what happened. And that's what
I thought was really cool, Charles, is the fact that we don't know anything about the other superhumans. We hear Khan refer to them.
Yep.
We don't know anything about them. Well, in this comic book, we find out that there were other superhumans, and they divided up the globe.
Yep.
And the thing that I thought was really cool, the thing that I was like, wow, was the fact that they all had different superpowers. I mean, that's not the right word. I'm using the wrong word. Not superpowers as in, you know, Superman and Wonder Woman powers. But, like, they had that one woman that had telekinetics. And they each develop a different super sense, whereas Khan got the intelligence. They all had the strength, and they each had their own.
Oh, the term like we did with Julian Regier, where you've got somebody who's genetically altered.
Genetically enhanced, I believe, is what he says. Yes, he's enhanced.
So you get this kind of thing, this genetic modifications, which makes them unique and special and their own group. So yeah,
it's interesting.
We get,
but they all. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that all the one common trait, though, is that they all end up in the end having a lust for power, right? They have this need to, like, take over. And it's interesting, Jim, I didn't pick up that they had, like, actually developed kind of, you know, superhuman power, so to speak. But what I did pick up on is that each one of them chose to exercise the powers that they had a little bit differently. In fact, the way the story was told, it was almost as if Khan was the one who was a little bit more benevolent. I mean, you had the one guy who was a total conqueror, the European dude who went through and, like, conquered everybody. And then you had the one woman who was, I can't remember if she was in the South Americas or the Middle Americas or somewhere, but she was all about herself. So she was fine with a small empire that was, you know, glorified her in a lot of ways. Khan was the one who kind of always seemed to keep his eyes on the prize and kind of think about, I mean, he says in the series here somewhere that we're all sheep and that we basically long to be ruled, and that essentially before they all started squabbling against each other, all of them, but then even after they started squabbling with each other, at least Khan was the one who seemed to always be doing it because it was what was best for the sheep, you know? He wasn't all about himself. He was about the sheep and about keeping sheep happy. So I thought that was kind of interesting because that was it was not a thread of his character that I really understood from the movie, and it was a thread of his character that I understood much more from this comic series.
They did make that point in the comic that his people revered him and chanted his name. And he fed them,
he was a benevolent leader.
Happy.
He was good. Yeah.
He, you know, as far as dictators go, he was a pretty good one.
Well, he has that one discussion. Yeah, I mean, he has that one discussion with the guy, and he's like, listen, if you don't keep your people happy, they're going to revolt. And in fact, in this comic series, that's what happened in China, right? They said that whoever was running China, it didn't work because there were a billion people there, and the numbers just simply overwhelmed them, and they didn't keep them happy. So even though it's kind of this era in the comic and then therefore in the movies of the genetic super people taking over the planet, there's still that story of revolt and revolution, or maybe not revolution, but at least revolt of one section just on sheer numbers, right? In fact, I think more than once they actually mentioned sheer numbers, that the people will always win because there's just more of them. I like that.
Yeah, it was a very good story. I did enjoy it. And it added a lot to that Khan character. And the thing is that you can take what you learned in this comic book and put it on Ricardo Montalban Khan. You can transpose it onto Cumberbatch's Khan, because I think the backstory is exactly the same, because it all takes place in the 90s.
Yeah, they both work. It is good.
Yeah, the only interesting thing, not really a complaint, I guess, and it totally makes sense for the story, but it was interesting to me. It didn't really feel like a Star Trek comic. You know, knowing the history and knowing it is helps, but it like the eugenics war and the creation of the super soldiers and stuff like that could have very well have been like an Image book or something. So not until like the fourth and the fifth issue did it really feel like a Star Trek book. But if you know the history, you know where it's coming from, then you can believe it's in the same universe.
Yeah, you're right. It didn't have that. It wouldn't have the Star Trek feel because we don't have the Federation yet. We don't have space travel yet. A lot of the things that we come to know and love about Star Trek haven't happened yet. So it didn't feel like a Star Trek book, other than we know who Khan is, which I thought was great. And you know, the one thing that I really liked when it starts out and we find out who Khan was to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and how he ends up, I was like, wow, I was really impressed with how they started him as a kid and what was going on with him as a kid versus where he eventually ended up.
Well, it sort of explains his determination, right? They say that you know, it starts back in 1972, and they've got these people who are evaluating these kids that they pulled off the streets in various places, and they recognize right away that this kid is the one who actually has what they're looking for, and they're interested in the very beginning in developing a soldier, and so when they're evaluating, there's that scene where Khan, for anybody who hasn't read the book yet, you know, he starts out as a kid with one leg, and he's kind of sitting there brooding, and they're talking about him, and this other kid tries to attack him, and he just goes crazy, and I don't know if he kills the other kid or if he just really beats him up pretty bad, but they say the one thing that they were looking for was unadulterated ferocity. And so we know, you know, when our Montalban Khan is quoting Shakespeare and you know, talking about how he's stabbing at Kirk and things. I mean, that all comes from his ferocity inside of himself. It's great. It's like what you were saying, Jim, that that this comic can apply to either Khan that we're familiar with from the two different movie series.
Yeah, and I, you know, I think the Wrath of Khan, in my opinion, is like, it's on the pinnacle of Star Trek movies. It's the movie that made Star Trek what it is today. It's right up there. It's in the top movies. And on any given day, you could ask me my favorite movie, and Star Trek II is going to be right up there. It's just a well-written, well-done movie. It has a great villain. The whole story flows. It works. And I think Ricardo Montalban bringing life to that character is what makes that movie so awesome. Because without a good villain, it doesn't – the movie – and we've seen that with other Star Trek movies. If the villain's not believable, the movie's believable. And Ricardo Montalban just brought Khan to life. And I think Cumberbatch, I think he was just as good a Khan, but in a different way. He didn't have that backstory episode to build upon. He had to create that character on the fly without the backstory that we all got from Space Seed with Ricardo. But I think both characters are very strong, very determined characters, and they're both driven by the same desires. And I think in the end, that's what makes those characters so unique.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting, maybe we should dive into that discussion if we've got time here, because they do play the characters completely differently. My take would be that Montalban's Khan tends to be a little bit more driven by his emotions. He seems to be, revenge-minded. He's got to get back at Kirk for all the things that he's done against him. To me, Benedict Cumberbatch did a little bit better job in playing the hyper-intelligent character, the one who's always kind of outsmarting the other one. Because ultimately, Montalban's Khan is defeated because he somehow can't think in 3D in space, right? I mean, that's kind of the one downfall of that movie, is like the smartest guy in the universe can't figure out that, space is not a two-dimensional plane. So I feel like Cumberbatch did a better job, or maybe the writers did a better job for Cumberbatch in allowing him to play that character a little bit more intelligently and a little less emotionally. And I'm not saying that either one is better or worse. I'm just saying that that's one of the big differences that I see between the two characters.
Well, I think that if you look at the Wrath of Khan, and you look at that Captain Kirk in the prime time, Kirk is the one who finds him. Kirk's the one that thaws him out. Kirk's the one that decides to strand him and Marla MacGyver's and the crew on SETI Alpha, and then flies away and never comes back and checks on him. And for all those years, Khan is blaming Kirk for that and for the loss of his wife. Whereas in Darkness, the one that Khan hates is Admiral Marcus, because Admiral Marcus takes on the role of Kirk in Space Seed.
Right.
So it's Admiral Marcus is the one that he's after, not so much Kirk. So we have a different dynamic there, whereas Khan is using Kirk. In fact, he says that at one point in the movie. He says, I think he's using us rather than us using him. He makes a line like that at some point. And I think that that's absolutely right. I think that Khan is using Kirk and Spock and the crew to get to Marcus to get his crew back. And he doesn't really care about Kirk and Spock. He just wants his crew. And in this case, he's using Kirk and Spock to get it. And in the original one, he was just after Kirk and Spock because of the hatred. So they were different ends of the spectrum.
For sure.
But still, I enjoyed Into Darkness, but it's a little bit different story than what we see of Khan in Wrath of Khan.
I mean, do you think that movie would have been more widely received had they included a little bit more Khan backstory in it?
Well, from what I heard from people, they didn't like the and this is mostly the Canaanites, didn't like the fact that Khan wasn't Asian, and they couldn't get over that fact. and they didn't like the fact that they felt insulted because you're taking one of their favorite characters, you're taking Khan, and you're taking one of the best Star Trek movies that they've made to date, and you're changing it into something different. And immediately, you know, you're going to have fans that are just going to shut right down. We want nothing to do with this. And they're not going to like it regardless of what you do. And I used to think, had they had that character be anybody but Khan, that the movie might have been better. But then the more I think about it, it had to be Khan for the movie to work. Because if they had created a character and said that he was Harry Ferry or Joe Blow, it wouldn't have had the emotional impact. It wouldn't have worked as well. It had to be Khan to make that story work.
Yeah, so just FYI, I looked it up in the interim since I asked myself the question of Ricardo Montalban's origin. So he's a Mexican actor. So he also doesn't fit the, you know, if folks are interested in the racial profile of Khan Noonien Singh, you know, he doesn't really fit the bill either. So, you know, the dynamic is a little bit different with Ricardo Montalban actually being a man of color and Benedict Cumberbatch being a European. So there is that difference. But, you know, we've had this discussion a million times too about the Kelvin universe and people's thoughts about it. You know, the Kelvin universe, or not universe, the Kelvin timeline is not the prime timeline. And so we do expect things to be different. We do expect things to be updated and different stories to be offered. And, you know, you might have a good point, Jim, if they had decided to, maybe if it was another genetic super person that wasn't Khan, maybe they could have made a story out of that and still kept some of the same parts of the story. But in some ways, Into Darkness had to be Khan. And like Charles was talking about, I love the fact that they kept it secret for so long. I mean, people were definitely guessing Khan for a little bit, but you know, I remember Gary Mitchell being a big discussion point, right? Everybody thought for a while there that Gary Mitchell was going to be the big villain that we would see in that movie. So you gotta be willing to go with the flow a little bit. Anytime it comes to Star Trek, it always comes back to the same versus TNG versus DS9 versus Kelvin. It's all about being able to versus Discovery. It's all about being able to change with the times and adapt. As long as you're producing good science fiction, I mean, that's what people really want to see, right? That's why they do it. That's why they watch it. They like good science fiction.
And, you know,
and it's all about the characters and the story.
I always thought that Ricardo Montalban came from Fantasy Island with Tattoo. Deplane. But that's just.
Well, did they ever say where Fantasy Island was? It's somewhere in the Bahamas, right? I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't know if they ever really do or not. But so
I feel
anyways,
like I remember him saying
I think,
Puerto Vallarta a lot.
I think overall that the IDW Khan from 2014, inspired by Star Trek Into Darkness, is an excellent read. And even if you're one of these anti-Kelvians, it doesn't matter. Like I said before, this story takes place in the 90s, World War III, the eugenics wars. So everything that happens in these five episodes very, very easily transposes onto Ricardo Montalban's Khan as we know and love him. It's the same character at this point. So everything that we see about him, all the events that happen on Earth, all the things that go on, still went on the same exact way in this comic as they would have with Ricardo's Khan. And that's the beauty of this comic book, I think. And if you haven't read it, you want to go out and try to find it, or call up Freakopolis Geekery and tell TJ to track down a copy for you, and he will, because it's definitely worth the read. You will not be disappointed. I can't recommend this book enough. What about you, Charles?
Uh,
or TJ?
I definitely recommend it. Gives a lot of context for Into Darkness and maybe smooths over some of the things that canonites, as you said, might complain about. Yeah, and sort of tells you about an interesting period in Star Trek history. So, yeah, you can find us at freakopolis.com or facebook.com/freakopolisgeekery if you want to get a copy. Be happy to do that for you. And some really great books tonight.
Yeah, before we go, I got Jamie back on the line here. Jamie, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you now.
So I lost you there. I wanted to get back to what you were saying. What did you think about this character of Khan and how he was portrayed in the darkness? Did you like that?
Yeah, I did, but I definitely agree. I think they could have maybe casted someone a little bit different to play his character more confidently. That's the right word I'm looking for, but that's the best way I can describe it right now.
Yeah, I remember coming out of the movies with you and your friend, and there was a guy in the lobby, and we were talking about it, and the guy, he had to be 22 maybe, and he comes over and he's like, "Yo, dude, like, there was another movie," and I had to tell him the whole story, and he's like, he'll have to go and see if he can find the Wrath of Khan." And I was like holding a vigil in the lobby. Remember, James? I'm like the wise old sage, and spreading my wisdom onto the youth of America. I was like, "Yeah, okay," and I just, it was just great to share the history of Star Trek with people that didn't know it existed. So that was pretty cool. So anyways, overall, let's go down and everybody can rank this book. So we'll start off with you, TJ. What do you think? Would you recommend this story to people?
I would recommend Khan to people. Yeah, definitely.
Now, how about you, Charles?
Even the people that don't like the Kelvin universe, I still recommend it because it's still a good tie into the story. I think the people would love to know, even with the original Wrath of Khan. So, yeah, definitely.
And how about you, Eric? What do you think?
Yeah, definitely recommended. I think I might have been the one who suggested this one up front. I love this book, actually. It ranks right up there. I think the art's good. I think the story is really interesting all the way through, and it gives you it feels like a little package, 5 issues. It really kind of just tightens up the story, fits very nicely into Star Trek Into Darkness. And I agree with what everybody's been saying about, even if you're not into the Kelvin timeline, I mean, the last issue 5, is a little bit more Kelvin timeline based, but all the other issues really deal a lot with the backstory back in the 70s, back in the 90s, and how Khan ends up being in space. So even for those of us who don't like those folks who don't like the Kelvin universe, Kelvin timeline, you can always enjoy this book anyway and just think of Ricardo Montalban.
Exactly. Well said. So, TJ, what's the next books? What are we going to be talking about on our next show?
So, for our next show, we will have 2 books, the current releases anyways. Terra Incognita starts this week with 1. That's the continuation of the Through the Mirror series that has been ongoing since, Free Comic Book Day last year? Barclay is finally on, is in the Prime universe, much like Lorca. He's got some machinations he's working towards. And then on August 1st, we're getting the final issue of this Star Trek Discovery Succession. We'll wrap that up.
And what about Star Trek Transformers?
Star Trek Transformers is coming out in... let's see, it's July now and August, I believe. Or no, excuse me, September.
September.
We got a little ways. Yep.
All right. So our next comic book corner is going to be on Monday, August 13th, same bat time, same bat channel. Succession issue number 4, Terra Incognito issue number 1. And we look forward to breaking down those books for you guys. Before we move on, though, before we say goodnight, I just want to let everybody know, if you didn't check out our show on Thursday, we had Mark Nakarato from the Romulan War on. We had a great time talking with him about his fan film. If you haven't had a chance to check out that show, please do. You can find us on iTunes under Trek Talk and Podcasts, or you can go to our Facebook page and click on the link there. And if you like what you hear and you like what you see, I have all the trailers for the Romulan War right there. Charles put up their Indiegogo campaign. And, you know, go over there and make a donation and help them out. We're going to be at Freakopolis Geekery on Wednesday from 6 to 8 doing In the Mirror Darkly OP event, 130 points, $5 entry fee. So me and Jamie both will be over there, so you can check that. I think the Ewok Karen may be joining us as well. So if you're in the area, stop by Freakopolis Geekery and say hello. And let's see, Thursday night we're going to be having another Trek Talking episode, as we always do. We have a lot of Star Trek rumors and theories to talk about. We're also going to talk about the new Ant-Man and Wasp movie as well, and all of our Star Trek polls, which you can currently go to Trek Talking on Facebook. Make sure that you vote. So, TJ, what's going on around Freakopolis Geekery before we go?
Yeah, as you said, Wednesday night, our next Star Trek Attack Wing OP, which should be pretty cool. I'm excited. We got the new deep cuts in. Actually, we got those in last week, I think, or the week before. And those look really nice. So I think we're going to see some on the table this week. Very excited. Thursday's D&D night from about 6 to 8 or so. We have a kids group and an adult group. We also have a kids comic club, which started last week. It's going on for 5 weeks. And we had like 16 kids. It was awesome. And then Star Wars Destiny on Friday. So lots of good stuff throughout this week.
They're going to be pretty busy.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. And how about you, Eric? What's going on with you?
Well, my wife's going out of town this weekend, so I'm on kid duty all weekend. But next Thursday, the 26th, will be our Star Trek Attack Wing casual night at Guardian Games here in Portland, 345 Southwest Southeast, excuse me, Taylor Street, just off of MLK. Not sure what we'll be doing yet, but we usually run 130-point fleets. I usually come up with something creative. Last month, we ran the mission against Cube 384. And had a lot of fun blowing that up, just barely. It was close. And so, yeah, we'll be doing that on Thursday the 26th there at Guardian Games.
Excellent. And how about you, Charles? What's going on out in Vegas?
Nate just posted his OP for Power 9 next Sunday. And he's going to run a free event that's going to be an Origin-style event. We're going to probably get a chance to play actually some ships with we could have actual faction penalties, such as like Eric did for the regionals up north. So that should be fun, since we're still waiting for a new OP kit. As TJ is as well. Yeah.
It's so long. Why is WizKids doing this to us? I'm sorry. I'm going to get on my horse a little bit here about this. We love this game, people. We love it, right? And all we want is even the bi-monthly support was okay. I mean, it was better back in the day when they gave us a monthly OP kit. And then they said, well, we're going to do it every other month. And then they said, well, now we're going to skip a couple of months here and there, and you'll be lucky. So I'm just a little disappointed. I don't think it's that hard. I mean, local TOs can come up with really cool scenarios with pretty minimal time investment. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know how long it took him to come up with one. Our TO came up with one that was excellent that we played this past weekend. he's a working guy. I'm sure he didn't put, you know, 40 hours into developing this OP sort of that we played. So how much time would it really take WizKids to do that and just publish a PDF? It feels like that's not very labor intensive. And I feel like it would help keep the community a little bit more engaged. When you have these long silences that last, you know, for months at a time from WizKids, I mean, at least they've been updating Worf, I will say. That's the one good thing that we've been getting. And we still have good discussions on the various community Facebook pages. But, you know, WizKids could be a little, like, very slightly more engaged with their audience, and I think it would go a long way. So if anybody from WizKids listens to this podcast, please just start giving us OPs. They're easy to develop. You know, they won't cost you a lot of money to publish. Just give us something to do each month. I feel like that's okay. And, you know, the prizes, I mean, the cards, they can't be that expensive to produce. You know, give us the card packs each month to be able to give out to people. It keeps people engaged in the game, and in the end, I believe will help them make more money.
Well,
now I'm off my soapbox.
TJ, what's the next? The Ragtag Fleet is the next one we're going to be expecting, right? With the Kelvin stuff.
We're expecting both another independent faction pack and a Kelvin Universe faction pack sometime this summer, supposedly. I think the independent was already supposed to release, but no word yet.
Actually, I had an interesting conversation with one of our players Sunday, and he said there was a press release that I guess I missed somewhere. WizKids made an announcement that there was such an uproar over the shortage of the starter kit that they put some of the new sets coming out on hiatus to go back and create more starters, because what the company was saying was they were limiting the orders to pre-orders only. They weren't doing an overrun of starters. And not enough people decided to do a pre-order. So there was no overrun, and then there were shortages. So supposedly they're trying to catch up and reprint so we've got more starters, and then events start going back. But the problem is too many stores are not pre-ordering at all, or not pre-ordering enough, which is why they're also making the request of fans, when they do get these items out there, get those pre-orders out there so that you can get them. And we're lucky that at least one of our stores knows they've got some dedicated players, so they order several at a time to be ready for it. But other stores are not doing that.
And you know what, Charles, that makes perfect sense, really, if you think about it, because when TJ got the starter sets in at Freak Obelisk Geekery, they were gone. I mean, they were gone. And we haven't seen any new ones show up on the shelf.
I'm not sure if we have any in town or not. But I know in other places, I've always heard in the community, there's demand. Where can we get starters? And people are saying starters are appearing on eBay above cost because people are trying to get them. So
yeah,
that's part of the problem that came up was they limited their orders, pre-orders only, and there was bigger demand. But they didn't know it because nobody wanted to, there's a new starter, I need to get it. Oh, but I didn't pre-order it or let my store know to get them. They didn't get anywhere near enough. So I think WizKids is realizing there's a problem and they've got to fix it. And we're starting to really realize, shipments are these ships are to create anymore.
Yeah, I mean, what I've heard is that there's a little bit of a chicken and the egg problem, because the WizKid says that they will, you know, follow up and produce what they need to produce if people pre-order, but people don't want to pre-order until they know what comes in the packs, right? They don't want to order a pack that they haven't seen every single card. I think maybe this is the new world we live in, where everybody wants to know exactly what they're getting before, you know, there's not a surprise factor like there is opening a, you know, a Magic booster or a Star Wars Destiny booster or something like that. So it's a little bit of a different dynamic. And I know I just put in my pre-order for the Vulcan faction pack that just came up at my game store. And, you know, I'm one of these people that I love the game, so I'm going to go ahead and pre-order everything new that comes out, and fortunately I'm able to do that. I know not everybody is. But you're right, Charles. It is all about people showing that they're interested a little bit prior to the product actually coming out, which takes a little bit of a leap of faith.
Yep.
Well, I know over at Freakopolis Geekery that when I'm running demo games, like at Adirondack Con or at Trek Conderoga, or, you know, wherever we happen to be, which, by the way, will be August 24th, 25th, and 26th in Ticonderoga, New York. Carl Urban and Robin Curtis will be there, and you can get a tour of the TOS Enterprise while you're there. Anyway, while I'm running the games, it's very easy for me to sell this game and get new people involved, because once they sit down and play the game, I can say, go over and see TJ, pick up a starter set, everything you need is in there, bring it back, we'll play the game. They run over to TJ, they get their starter set, they come back to the table, and I got a fan of the game now. And that's how we pick up a lot of new players. However, when that starter set's not available, people can't get it, makes it harder for me to sell the game and get new players involved, because they can't get the dice, you know, the stuff that comes in that starter set. So they need to get those starter sets out there so that we can grow the community. Would you agree, TJ?
Yeah, totally. I mean, we've been looking for starter sets since, you know, the month they came out, pretty much. We got in probably, I don't know, we might have got like 8 in, and they sold immediately. And now it's hard to get anybody new into the game. We know Trek Conderoga's coming up. I would love to have like at least like a dozen to bring up there, because you guys are going to be working the game room all day, and Attack Wing is clearly going to be a prominent game there. So if we can have a dozen to bring up, that would be great. Get some new players, even if they're not like in our local area. And, you know, make a little bit of money. And, because it's hard, you know, as long as we can get them before Chuck Conderoga, I'll be happy. That would be great. It's going to be hard for you to sit down with people, demo the game, and then we'll have a table full of ships, but nothing that comes with the dice or the rule book or the movement templates or anything. So, yeah, we really need to, I'm praying to God that they have some new starter sets available. You know, the same starter set available, just new printing by late next month, I hope.
That would be good. And, Jamie, you get to bring up the caboose here. I mean, what are your plans? What's going on with you?
Not much. I'll be there at the game on Wednesday, and it would be nice to see some familiar faces or new faces. I mean, we're always open to new players if you're in the area, and that's about it.
Yeah, and, you know, before we wrap up, I just wanted to say thank you to TJ for spending some time with us, and thank you to Charles, and thank you to Eric, and thank you to Jamie. You guys are great. I'll talk to all you guys on Thursday night for Trek Talking, and we have a great show planned for then, and Comic Book Corner, presented by Freakopolis Geekery, will be on August 13th. So make sure you check that out. And you can find us on iTunes under podcast. So check that out. Make sure you subscribe so you never miss a show. And I guess all of our old shows are there as well. So all 3 seasons of Trek Talking are all there. So go back and browse them and give them a listen. And you can actually, you can listen to some of my older co-hosts. I've gone through a lot of them. So the show has changed over the years. So you go back and listen to some of the early shows and see how it's changed. So come back and join us next week. Check out our Facebook page. And thanks a lot to everybody. And we'll see you guys all on Thursday. Good night, everybody.
Good night,
y'all.
Let's see what's out there.